Elias, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Brathwell, Judge Flory, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. I'm glad everyone got here safely. I apologize for the delay, but I had some difficulty getting in here, but I didn't crash, so there you go. as all parties are aware, our first case this morning is A23-1275, Hoskin versus, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Krasnack. As all parties are aware, the appellant in total will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Based on correspondence we received, I believe appellant's counsel are splitting their time. So if you could just tell me what that's going to be, that would be helpful. So who's going first? Is it Ms. Alton or Mr. Cron?
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm going first. I'll take the first 10 minutes. Mr. Cron will address the attorney's fee issue, reserve 5 minutes for him, and I'll handle the reply myself.
Great. So you'll do everything except the fees?
Right.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, then, when you're ready, if you could just approach the microphone. The podium goes up and down. If you could adjust the microphone to your level, and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Certainly, Your Honor. My name is Lorena Alton. As you noted, I represent Doug Hoskin, the appellant and plaintiff in the underlying matter. I would just like to start out with a brief introduction to the underlying factual allegations of the complaint. In this case, Mr. Hoskin was a member of a company called IPC. IPC was engaged in the business of owning, operating, and managing various parking facilities. They had some other real estate investments and things like that. And during the worldwide pandemic,
no one was parking downtown.
Right. The company was struggling. It needed emergency financing. And Mr. Krasnack, who was the manager and also a member of IPC, did commit to go and get that financing. Separately and apart from that issue with IPC's overall business, Krasnack and Hoskin were discussing a potential transfer of Hoskin's assets to Krasnack in exchange for monetary payment. They scheduled a meeting in order to discuss that potential transfer or transaction, and unbeknownst to Hoskin, Krasnack had scheduled that meeting to coincide with the last day to apply for a federal program for emergency financing for companies that found themselves in IPC's condition. That was a special program that had a limited time period of application due to the federal government's sort of pandemic allocation of value. When he arrived at that meeting, Hoskin learned from Krasnack that Krasnack was going to demand the transfer of assets for less than the value. He had pre-drafted agreements that he demanded Hoskin sign with no negotiation or edits, and at a lower value than Hoskin thought should be awarded for his assets. Krasnack informed Hoskin that unless he executed these agreements as they were written, he was going to tank the financing that IPC needed in order to survive. Hoskin couldn't afford that. It would end his livelihood. And under objection and duress, he did execute those agreements.
I just want to make sure that I understand. I'm looking at page 10 of your addendum 40. Is this the exact representation that you're saying was fraudulent? I'm not going to get the Main Street unless we get this done. Doug, if you don't sell me along the lines and prices that we are discussing now, Interstate would be in a world of hurt if they don't get that loan. So is that the exact representation you're saying?
That is the exact quote.
Okay.
The discussion was longer than that. I mean, I believe he went back and re-represented to Hoskin that there was going to be a world of hurt if IPC didn't get this financing, and that was hinged directly on him executing these agreements that Hoskin was objecting to.
My concern is, and I realize this is different from the rescission, you know, return the money before you get to have your lawsuit argument, but is that really a misrepresentation of a present or past material fact? I mean, if you don't transfer me your assets, I won't apply for this loan in the future. I mean, I thought that fails as a matter of law.
Well, my understanding was that the application was already present, and he was saying he was going to derail the financing that was going to be applied for, and that the last day to submit that application was the next day. And we have two separate claims in the complaint as to fraud. One was, at the time that he agreed to obtain the financing, he knew in advance that he was only promising to do that in order to railroad off any other opportunity, in order to get leverage over Hoskin and force him to transfer his assets. So that, yes, when he represented...
Just so I'm clear, he had not applied for the loan. I mean, it would be different if he's... I think it would be different if he had already applied for the loan and said, I'm not going to apply for the loan unless you sign the transfers, because then that's a misrepresentation of a past material fact. He had applied for the loan. But here he had not applied for the loan yet, even if he had filled out all the forms. He had not submitted it to the government. Would that be a fair statement?
We don't know, Your Honor. We weren't allowed to engage in discovery. But that's what I was raising, is that in count two,
well,
we
isn't
say-
that your problem on rule? I mean...
Counsel, so we are dealing with the allegations in your complaint, right? It's not about what you later discover.
Right, certainly.
So help us out in understanding what this misrepresentation is.
Absolutely. Okay. If I could address the two misrepresentations that are alleged in the complaint. The second misrepresentation that is alleged in the complaint was that at the time Kurznak told Hoskin that he was going to derail this financing, he did not actually intend to do so. It was either already submitted, he didn't have the power to get rid of it.
Counsel, I have the same problem Judge Connolly does with that. You know, does not intend to do something in the future doesn't sound like a representation of past or present fact.
If he's representing to Hoskin that he's going to be able to derail the financing or will derail the financing, and he knows at the time he's making that representation that it is false, that
Wait a second, though. As I understand, your complaint is quite clear in its allegations that am I saying it right, Kurznak? And we'll let counsel correct
I've
me.
I've been saying Kurznak.
But Mr. Kurznak does have you make many allegations about his ability to control financing through the bank, AEB, and that's sort of, it's a premise of your claim, if we're going to take those as true.
But if those are lies, in count two...
So he wasn't able to derail financing.
That is what count two alleges. That he was not actually going to derail the financing.
That's different
that he
from
could not.
Able to derail.
Right. That's why we say that his representations that he had the relationship with American Bank were false and misleading. That's
okay.
Count two.
Okay.
In count one, we allege that at the time that he agreed to go, you know, undertake as an agent to find financing and obtain it, that that was a representation that he made concealing the fact at the time that he knew he would not actually do that, but was just saying he would in order to gain leverage over Hoskin. That count one is a fraudulent concealment, and count two is fraudulent inducement.
But all right, then let's try. As a matter of law, how could there have been reasonable reliance on that representation? Because if he didn't apply for the loan, everybody's interests would have, you know, gone down the toilet.
Well, he had a smaller interest in IPC than Hoskin, so he would not have been damaged to the same extent that Hoskin was. But that is part of count two, that in fact he...
The ramps are now full now, are they?
My understanding is that I don't...
Milwaukee is much, much different than downtown Minneapolis.
I think people are parking again, Your Honor.
So, counsel, I have a slightly different question. I don't want to, you know, stop you if you'd like to pursue reliance, but it seems to me when I read Sorensen and look at that case law as to how fraud or duress relate to our examination of a release, whatever the fraud is that is being alleged, because we're at the Rule 12 stage and we're going to take all of your allegations as true, it has to relate to the release, as opposed to relating to some other transaction. And when I read your complaint, the fraud, whether it's non-disclosure or express representations and the duress that is argued, relate to actually the transfer. You know, you talk about getting leverage, right, over your client to force the sale at an excessively low price. And those allegations don't relate to the release.
The allegations relate to the execution of the entirety of the contract, that he was not entitled to a release, and in fact, the inclusion of the release itself is evidence that Kurznak knew that what he was demanding was unlawful.
But your complaint has no allegations about the release. The release comes in because your complaint alleges this contract, and then under our rules, we get to, you know, examine the entirety of the contract, right?
The release came in because they raised it as a defense.
Correct.
But the transfer agreement, the title of the transfer agreement, is raised in the complaint, and the entirety of the agreement is induced by fraud. And I did want to return to the duress point, because in all of the court's decisions on duress, those are threats of future acts. It's a subset of fraud, but in Wise, the threat was, I'm going to financially ruin you in the future. I'm going to sue you in the future.
But it's an unlawful threat. I mean, that's a different line of analysis, so you can go there if you want.
Sure.
Wise relates to an unlawful threat, because as the court explains in great detail, there was absolutely no ability for the employer to undertake the lawsuit that it was alleging and explicitly alleged in bad faith.
And in Kramer v. Kramer, it was that it was going to be, that the wedding was going to be canceled. There's no specific statute saying that you have to marry somebody after you've proposed to them. That is a threat of a future act that will change the circumstances of the person that's being threatened. So in the case of duress, it's always a threat of future activity. And they're unlawful because the threat that was made by Kurznak in this case was similarly, I'm going to financially ruin you by undermining IPC, by ensuring that IPC is not going to get its emergency financing. And that was both fraudulent, but also a violation of his duties both to the entity and to Kurznak, because he had fiduciary duties and he had the duty of good faith and fair dealing. I do want to address your questions, but I did promise some time to my colleague here. Is there anything I can answer before I allow him to take his turn?
No. If you do want to sum up, since you kind of, you know, that would be fine, too.
Certainly. I am glad that you did ask me to clarify the points of the complaint, because the court also expressed some idea that the word not in the complaint was a typo. But in fact, he was misrepresenting that there was not going to be financing.
That's a loser. I agree.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Alton. Mr. Cron, sir?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jeremy Cron, and I also represent appellant Doug Hoskin. And with the brief time we have remaining, I'd like to discuss...
But we don't get to any of this if we reverse and send it back, right?
Yes, that is correct. If we reverse and send it back, the attorney's fees issue...
Does not
come into play. There is no prevailing party.
Yes.
Yes. There were two errors in this case as it pertains to the fees award. The first, the district court misinterpreted the fee shifting provision to apply in this case. And the second is that the district court unilaterally assumed the role of fact finder as to the reasonableness of the fees requested and deprived Mr. Hoskin of his constitutional right to a jury trial on that issue.
On the second issue, counsel, the denial of a jury trial, the district court reasoned it through by saying that it did fall to you, your client, your side of the litigation, to generate an issue of material fact on the reasonableness of attorney's fees, and that you failed to do that in response to the motion for attorney's fees.
And in doing so, we believe that the district court essentially adopted a summary judgment standard by finding no genuine issue of material fact, despite neither party moving for summary judgment and without giving Mr. Hoskin proper notice that the court was going to be applying that standard. One can imagine a case where a party offers...
So help me out in understanding how, you know, again, assume I agree with you, and that there was a procedural error in the way the district court reasoned through the motion for attorney's fees. How are you prejudiced exactly? Because you did have a full opportunity to respond and review all the documentation. It's not as though the district court took evidence that was different from the evidence that you responded to.
I mean, being a non-dispositive motion, Mr. Hoskin had 7 days to respond primarily to the impact of the attorney's fees provision, whether or not that applied. That was issue number one. Number two, as to whether the specifics of the fees. Mr. Hoskin did raise issues on the reasonableness of those fees, but as United Prairie Bank confirms, Mr. Hoskin is entitled to a more fulsome opportunity to respond to that and present evidence than merely.
And did you request a hearing?
We requested a jury trial, yes, and throughout, and
but in response to the motion, did you request a hearing or an extension of time if you're complaining about the 7 days?
I believe there was a hearing.
No, I'm an evidentiary hearing,
sorry, yes.
I think, is what we're looking at. Yeah.
Yes.
I believe that in the papers that may have been brought up. As to the fee-shifting provision itself, it states that in any action to enforce this agreement, the prevailing party shall be entitled to recover from the other party its costs and attorney's fees. And what really matters here is what it means to be an action to enforce together. And there's no definition or anything else in the transfer agreements that elaborates on what that means, but Mr. Hoskin has...
Is the release part of the agreement?
The release is part of the transfer agreement.
Aren't they acting to enforce the agreement if they're saying the release bars your claims and responding with a motion and filing a motion to dismiss?
They are bringing forth an affirmative defense that the release applies.
How else would they do that except with a motion to dismiss if they don't want to go through, you know, a trial?
Bringing some sort of...
Should they have brought a separate action to enforce or to enforce the action?
Not necessarily, but that doesn't mean the attorney's fees provision here applies in this case, because it applies to an action to enforce. We've cited case law, and I would point specifically to this court's case in Akinola versus Southampton Apartments as an example, which is cited on page 41 of Mr. Hoskin's opening brief. And in that case, the court distinguished between cases that were actions to enforce and those that weren't. And specifically, the court found that actions to enforce included claims for breach of contract. But cases that only involved torts, such as here, or even a declaratory judgment, were not. And the court cited several cases from other jurisdictions for that proposition, including one from Idaho and a few from Oregon. Now, in this case, Mr. Hoskin is the only party that has asserted claims, and it's undisputed that he has not alleged any claims for breach of contract, and he's not seeking to enforce the agreement. Instead, he's alleging a series of torts and seeking to invalidate the agreement. The only reason the transfer agreements are at issue here is because respondents raised it in defense of the lawsuit, but the defense
so if,
is not
if you
an
won,
action to enforce.
Let's say we send this back, summary judgment is denied. It goes to trial, you win. Do you get your attorney's fees pursuant to this agreement?
No, we do not. No, we do not, because
you're not trying to enforce the...
We are not trying to enforce it. And I realize that attorney's fees may not be, in this action, may not be available to either party, but that is what the plain language of the transfer agreements calls for. Because this is seeking to
invalidate
the agreement.
You're not trying to enforce the agreement.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Now, the provision, therefore, doesn't apply. We would ask that the attorney's fees award and order be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Last time I was here, I went after somebody who was about 6'6". That felt particularly unfair.
Well, we like that it goes up and down because it cost us $200,000 for that podium.
It's terrific, and it makes you feel like you're at the U.S. Supreme Court where I think the original was. May it please the court, my name is Art Boylan. I represent the respondents, Josh Krznak and JT Manager, LLC. This is... a regrettable case. We've got five agreements.
Because they should have gotten more money?
I wouldn't put it that way, Your Honor.
Did he actually get the 250, or perhaps it was 240, plus the attorney's, plus the salary?
My understanding is all compensation that was owed to him pursuant to the transfer agreements.
And does the record indicate what the total number was?
I think it was about $280,000.
Thank you,
Your Honor. I don't want to misrepresent anything.
I'm not going to
hold you to it. It was about 280.
Yeah.
And in exchange for that, we have transfer agreements, and in each of those transfer agreements, there's a robust release. The risk arising from a case like this is overcomplicating it. They've got a variety of dealings. They come to...
Do you think they've done a good job?
Excuse me?
Don't you think they've done a very good job of that? It's a 10-count complaint.
I think that counsel is very skilled. I will grant opposing counsel that. But we don't make up our facts either. And the facts here include five different
releases.
Does
the doctrine of economic coercion exist under Minnesota state law?
No.
And what is your best case that says that?
Well, the Olmstead case says it most clearly, Your Honor. And it said it in our brief. And frankly, all the briefing on both sides I thought was very well done. It's right in our brief describing, I think that's actually a Eighth Circuit case, but that does a great job of repeating, here's the standard right now in Minnesota. And there's no doubt that that is the standard.
Does that case involve a release?
Your Honor, I don't recall if it involved a release. I don't believe it did.
That's my follow-up question to you. Mm-hmm. I understand where you have ample authority for the proposition that Minnesota has not recognized economic duress.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there are some cases that have examined releases to determine whether the party that's challenging the release in fact intended to enter into a release.
Mm-hmm.
And as you are aware from the briefing, you know, a series of factors, six factors, that can be examined to make that determination. And when apparently there is at least one of them, two of them, three of them, I mean, I'm not sure what the case law tells me. You can go on about that. Mm-hmm. But if those factors are present, it may be the release is invalid. So,
Your Honor, if you indulge that, first of all, this is a big if. If there's the economic duress doctrine, let's look at releases in particular. And I think this is kind of the slippery slope the district court got into. Then I think in this particular case, and this is where we got to be careful not to overcomplicate things. In this particular case.
Our best.
I appreciate it, Judge. But in this particular case, we don't have evidence or allegations, I should say, because it rises and falls on their complaint, that actually demonstrate that sort of inequitable conduct. And let me go on just for a moment.
Counsel, I don't know if you want to go there. I mean, in light of our standard of review under Rule 12 and the nature of the allegations we have.
Oh.
I mean, inequitable conduct, I think, is the easiest hurdle that if we view the... Again, the allegations and the like, I'm not talking about the truth of the matter or what would be proven at trial or determined by a jury, only viewing the allegations in a light favorable to the plaintiff, the non-moving party in this case.
Sure. What they center on, though, Your Honor, is fraud, right? And they've not got entirely.
I mean, promissory estoppel is an equitable claim. The district court, I mean, if you didn't appeal, district court did determine that the promissory estoppel claim would go forward. Setting aside the release, obviously.
What they claim is the unlawful, and take a look at their reply brief. This is where they lean into it heavily. The unlawful conduct here was fraud, in their view. And
counsel, I feel as though both parties, you know, mix and match whenever it's convenient to them. Obviously, fraud and duress are crucial because if they are in play in this case, say raising a question of fact, allowing the plaintiff to proceed with discovery, then that, you know, threatens the validity of the release. On the other hand, in terms of looking at the full merits of the plaintiff's claim, we do look at things like, do they have an equitable claim? Only if we set aside the release, though, right? Because everyone agrees the release is very broad here.
So I'm not sure I'm understanding your question, Your Honor.
Yeah, and I'm not understanding your argument. You go ahead.
Here's the way I'm thinking about this. Look, there may be exceptions, maybe. I don't think there are. But let's assume for a minute that you could look at a release a little bit differently. Here they say there was fraud. The problem with their fraud allegation, and I think that's the undercurrent of everything, their allegations say they show up at the day of. Fraud typically is, I'm concealing something from you. Their allegations in the complaint are, my client arrives at this meeting and says, this is what I'm going to do or not do. That is no longer fraud. In their factual allegations, and you can look from about paragraph 25 to about paragraph 55 of their facts in their complaint, they actually don't have facts that relate to fraud. And Your Honor, going to somebody and saying, I'm telling you exactly what I'm going to do if you don't do what I ask you to do, that's not fraud.
So, counsel, you are arguing, though, with their allegations, because their allegations are that the statements that were made by your client on the 18th were false. He was going to go ahead and get a loan to save IPC, but he was simply negotiating, you know, in a, they claim, an equitable way.
But then, Your Honor, then we're falling right back into the Martins case from 2000. My intent about a future act can't be fraud.
Right, and certainly that is a different point. But you seem to be saying that there is no falsity or non-disclosure alleged. It is alleged. It's a different issue to say whether it's about a past or present fact.
I agree they're two separate issues. One, it's about a future act. Two, he fully discloses it. So I'm not sure what the fraud is. What they then do in their brief, and you're right, they kind of mix and match, Your Honors, they say, you know, he kind of committed at one point, and he was going to be the lead person. This is their brief talking, not the allegations of the complaint. Our client relied on him to be the person that was going to be arranging for this Main Street loan. You go to the complaint, and you go from 25 to 55, there are no specifics surrounding that. And that's another reason why there isn't a valid fraud claim here to support what they would like to do. Now, they make a good argument of it, no doubt. Some of the, when you get into the counts, they will describe the rote sort of, he reasonably relied on his representations. But if you look at the actual allegations from 25 to 55, you don't have a statement, the way you have a statement from December 18 that they allege that is back in September or October saying, I will be the person that will go get the IPC. You can rely on me to go get the loan, not the IPC. And as a result, that was fraudulent at that time. And that's a separate reason why we got to be really careful here. And that drives me back to the release, which is there is no question that this sort of allegation, these sort of claims, are covered by the release, Your Honor. And I think that we all agree on that at a minimum. Your Honor also said, and I think your question was spot on, it's not enough just to say, hey, there may have been fraud in general. Because under our Sorensen case, the fraud actually has to relate to the release, right? And so here we've got allegations about other dealings, other statements, not related to the actual release that needs to be enforced. And I think that's a separate problem that they have that they don't earnestly deal with. And as a result of that line of cases as well, we've got to be clear that releases ought to be upheld.
Can you really separate them? I mean, if there's allegations of fraud in the mm-hmm. transfer agreements, and part of the transfer agreement is the release, it seems a little silly to, not your argument's not silly, but it seems a little silly to suggest, yeah, they've alleged fraud in the transfer agreements, but we got this release thing in here that's part of that that says even if we did commit fraud in the transfer agreements, you can't sue us because you've released a claim. I mean, it seems to me they're all one and the same. It's one document, isn't it?
This is where we got to be careful. I mean, maybe a judge, but I had an old mentor that said, be careful, bad facts make bad law, right? And here we've got we're all kind of struggling to square the circle. And part of that is, there's the obvious answer is things are covered by the release. Your point, Your Honor, is, well, how do you separate the two necessarily? And how do you deal with this case law, Sorensen, the fraud would have to relate to the release? If there was some undisclosed fact, you're releasing on behalf of officers, directors, employees, et cetera. The lie, these are made up facts, the lie is, I happen to be a director, an officer, but you don't know it. Sign right here, and then it turns out the next day, the person who signed this release didn't realize that they were releasing me as an officer or director or employee.
What if he
that
said,
would touch on the release.
What if he had said, I have an appraisal that shows this property is only worth $250,000, and therefore that's all I'm going to give you. And in fact, he has an appraisal that he doesn't disclose that shows the property is worth $1 million. And then, you know, he gets the 250, he signs the release, and they sue saying fraud. You know, he had an appraisal that said the property's worth $1 million. Does your release, let's say that's the fraud allegation, does your release get you around that?
It depends. And the reason that I say that, does the agreement include, for example,
it's this release language, the exact release language that's in this contract.
Agree. But does it have a representations and warranty clause? Does it say, I have disclosed to you all information I have regarding the value of the properties? We both are of equal footing. I'm trying to think of the other terms where you could have the same sort of fraud touching on the release that would actually be the sort of fraud that would give us an opportunity to get around a release.
Was there, well, fair enough. Was there a representations clause in this contract? If there was, then it gets away from, you know, well, then who cares whether I'm going to get a loan or not?
I don't believe there are, Your Honor. And
so do you lose then? Because to follow up on the logical extension of your argument, do you then lose because there isn't such a clause in this contract?
No, because the difference is in affirmative representation. That would be the fraud that would touch on the release versus the absence of one.
I'm not going to get a loan, even though I've already filled out all the paperwork to get the loan, except I haven't mailed it to the Department of Commerce. Let's say those are the facts.
Number one, not alleged in our complaint. Number two, you hit on it earlier. Is that reasonable? Could it be reasonable reliance? I think there's a whole series of problems with that.
Is reliance a fact question?
Well, I think it depends on which fact we're relying on. Reasonable reliance is something that a court could decide on a motion to dismiss.
As a matter of law?
I think as a matter of law, yes.
Do you have a case that says that?
Off the top of my head, no, I do not.
All right. Well, we have great clerks, so... I'm sure they'll find
one. You do have terrific clerks. I note that I've only got a minute left
and
here.
And we're grilling you a lot, so.
I appreciate the grilling.
Take an extra minute or two.
A couple of things. Really briefly to touch on the attorney's fees piece. This is abuse of discretion for a good reason. I think the court did the right
thing. Speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, if we affirm, I think this argument that enforcing the action is not one that I am inclined to believe.
And I believe we cite cases that suggest that your way of thinking about it is correct in our brief. Second thing, I don't think this court wants to be in the business of doing a de novo review of the post-judgment award of attorney's fees in any case. Abuse of discretion is the right standard. The court looked at it carefully. There was an opportunity to be heard. There was a notice of motion, an amended notice of motion. There was a hearing, and there was an opposition. We shouldn't have any qualms about that. And frankly, under the abuse of discretion standard, the way the court decided to decide that issue should also be subject to abuse of discretion.
So
ultimately,
do you agree that if we were to not affirm the district court in all respects here and send some or parts of this case back for further litigation, that the attorney's fees becomes a moot issue then on the prevailing party determination that the trial court made?
Or would you like us to issue an advisory opinion that says this enforcing an action is nonsense?
I think we send it back.
Right.
Your Honor, I don't think it becomes a moot issue because it depends on how it goes back.
Well, maybe moot's not the right word. Right. But, I mean, is it an issue that we choose not to address or defer to a later date if there's going to be further district court litigation? I don't know. It's not the most artful way of putting it, but basically I'm saying if you don't win at all issues, on all issues mm-hmm. here at the Court of Appeals on your case, mm-hmm. then did the court err in determining that you were the prevailing party? I mean, you were in part, but then they would have been in part. That, I think it points out to the difficulties of this award in the Rule 12 setting because it's a whole different analysis.
I don't know if it is, Your Honor, because if we have won and we prevailed in an action, we ought to be entitled to our attorney's fees under this. And I think your colleague has indicated there's case law out there on this. I think that if you were to send this back and later, I'm very confident ultimately we will be the prevailing party. It's not a part of the record. When I know about the rest of the story, I'm very confident that ultimately we're going to need to be the prevailing party in this case. And so, Your Honor, I think that saying it was appropriate under these circumstances to find that we were the prevailing party and this is how you interpret an action to enforce release, I think that would be acceptable. I know that there's issues with advisory opinions. I'd also say, and then I'll be quiet and sit down. I got to go back to where I started. These are sophisticated commercial real estate people. These are business people. They're represented by counsel. They sit down and they have a negotiation, and ultimately they enter into 5 release or agreements that transfer in interest in LLCs, and they exchange money for that. In connection with that, they have a release in each of the agreements. That should be the end of it. And Your Honor, I've been accused of being simple before. I think this is a real simple case, and that's where it's got to start and end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now hear for counsel for appellant on rebuttal.
I can set a timer.
For 5 minutes.
If that's helpful. Thank you very much. Thank you. You've obviously paid careful attention to the pleadings and this matter, for which we appreciate it. I did have a few points that I wanted to discuss and reply. One was the issue of economic coercion. The only opinion that I recall reading in preparation for today that said that there was no economic coercion in Minnesota was a Eighth Circuit case. And I would say that in general, most of the cases we've cited before the court involve a pecuniary interest, a property interest of some kind, a financial injury, and that there are several instances in which this court and the Supreme Court have recognized that even though that threat was financial in nature, it still showed duress. And they explicitly stated in at least 2 cases, Wise and Kramer v. Kramer, that it was not the nature of the threats that defined whether or not there was duress, but the surrounding circumstances, the immediacy of the circumstances, the ability to negotiate, the whether or not they had sufficient
but
time.
But whether someone applies for a loan or not is not an illegal act, right? Applying for a loan or not applying for a loan is not an illegal act.
It is. I would say, Your Honor, that it's a coercive act. And if you look, for example, at Joannan v. Ogilvie, the case said that duress lies where there is an actual or threatened exercise of power possessed or supposed to be possessed by the party exacting a payment over the person or party making the payment
from which the latter has no other means of immediate relief other than by advancing that payment. And that's a quote of that case. And coercive acts are
unlawful. From 1892.
Yes, and it is a Supreme Court case that has never been overruled. It's still good law in this jurisdiction.
But normally, I think if we were looking for, the existence of economic duress, it would have come up more recently. Someone would have said, oh, by the way, that is a valid subset of duress.
Your Honor, financial duress is duress. We have made a claim of duress. The defendant has inserted the word economic before that because they're hoping to rely on case law that says whether it lies in this jurisdiction is ambiguous. I will note in other cases they have said it's not duress that's economic if the financial circumstance is just created by the overall business, a general want of pecuniary needs. Here it was created by the acts of the defendant to wait until the last minute to schedule a meeting where there were no alternatives available and say, I'm going to tank IPC unless you sign these agreements. And I think that whether or not that damage would have been financial is not relevant. It's not a relevant consideration under the Minnesota laws. I'm reading it.
So you and I are going to, I'm going to sell you a house. And you want to buy a house, and we agree that the purchase price is $100,000. And on the day of the closing, I say, unless you give me another $10,000, I'm not going to go forward. I don't want to sell you the house anymore. You give me the extra $10,000, and then a year later you sue me. Have I engaged in economic coercion?
I don't believe so because there's no exigent circumstances around that. Maybe if you're already in the house and you have nowhere to move and you say, well, now I disagree after you've already taken acts on reliance of the representations I've made to you and you already thought this sale went through and now that you've got no other option, you can't buy another house that's on the market, now I'm letting you know that, in fact, I never, you know, recorded the deed or actually had title to this or you can't move in. I think that the difference here is that what makes it coercive is the fact that acts were taken in reliance upon the representations that were made. There were no other, there's not another way to get this particular type of financing. And it was so late in the day, I think I said in my brief, if he had months before said, I don't have time, you know, can we transfer this to another manager? But that's not what he did. Instead, he deliberately created circumstances where my client had no other option by the time he sprung his trap. I did want to return to Wise. I know the court's very familiar with it. I would just note that we have spent some time on whether or not there can be fraudulent inducement on the contract as a whole, or whether or not you have to show separate fraud as to each separate term in that contract. I'm not aware of law saying that you have to show that each term of a contract that was fraudulently induced or coerced has to be separately addressed explicitly in a complaint in order to proceed. And I will note that, in fact,
I read that in the Sorensen case. I'm just reading it wrong. No, I'm serious. Did you look at the Sorensen case?
Yes, I did read the Eighth Circuit case.
Sorensen is not an Eighth Circuit case. That's a case out of this court.
What I was saying about Wise was that that is a release case, but that release also included a term under which payment would be provided to the plaintiff. So it's not as though, you know, there were separate terms as well there, including the exchange of financial remediation, that he was paid $200 and that also his attorney's fees were paid. So they didn't have to show fraud as to each of those separate claims. And just because there was an exchange of compensation didn't mean that it wasn't a release that was subject to an argument of duress. And I also wanted to point to that case for the argument that they have made that we had to return all money received for the membership assets in order to proceed with the case. In that case, the Wise case, the $200 was provided explicitly in exchange for the release, and there was an additional $100 explicitly provided for attorney's fees, essentially his damages. In this case, we were provided money for not for a release, but for the property assets. If there's some breakdown between some of it's for the release or some of it's for the property assets, that's a matter of equity or a matter of fact to be determined. And the cases, including Wise, acknowledges that if some part of the payment received is for something other than the release, there's no obligation to return it. And they explicitly hold in the Wise case that the $100 does not have to be returned for that reason in order for the case to be, for the contract to have been successfully repudiated. I did think when I was preparing here today, there was a case that actually considered this issue of whether the contract as a whole could be would fraudulently induced. And if I just could not find it while I was sitting here. If it's all right, I would submit it by letter, same allowance to Art Boylan without argument.
On that note, people can comply with the rules of appellate procedure about whether there's some new case. I will just say, speaking for myself and not my treasurer colleagues, unless our court has directly ruled tomorrow on some issue relevant to this, I don't think you get to write a letter.
I appreciate that. It's simply a case that we already cited that I couldn't find while I was trying to prepare for my rebuttal.
We'll find it.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Alton. Thank you, Mr. Cron. Thank you, Mr. Boylan. The matter was well briefed and well argued. We will issue our decision within 90 days.